Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will join us here in just a moment. We're going to be getting a primer on the U.S. Constitution. Coming off the holiday weekend, wherein here in America we're celebrating independence, the Declaration of Independence, often confused with the U.S. Constitution, and confused in more than one way, not only as a matter of history, but also because, of course, we have the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and then we do not have the U.S. Constitution fully ratified and enacted for another 13 years. Okay, so there's the first confusion, but also the Declaration of Independence makes broad use of, in a generic way, the deity, God. Does the U.S. Constitution mention God? Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest during this hour. I invite your questions and your comments as we talk about the U.S. Constitution, and we'll also be talking about the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's a professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He has authored and edited more than 50 books, including one called The Shaping of America. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much.
First of all, let's clear up the confusion that often exists between the two founding documents of the United States, being the Constitution, the subject of our conversation, and the Declaration of Independence.
The Declaration of Independence is simply an assertion, a public assertion of the separation from England, and a statement of general principles, and that, therefore, does not constitute a legal document at all. Whereas the Constitution of the United States is a legal document. It's the basis by which the laws of the country, as passed by legislatures, can be judged to determine whether they are in accord with the fundamental principles of the nation. So we have here a statement of ideals, that's the Declaration of Independence, and then we have the legal foundation on which the country is established, that's the Constitution.
Now, I want to get into the history in a moment, but then what's going on between July 4, 1776, and the ratification and enactment of the U.S. Constitution in 1788-89?
The various states endeavored to reach a common agreement in that period on the legal foundation for a federal union. And this is what the Constitution represents. It's the common understanding of what the country's legal foundation should properly be. And a Constitution is a very, very important document. It's important because if you don't have entrenched principles of government, then any legislature, any meeting of Congress, for example, in the United States, or any meeting of Parliament in England could enact anything. They could change the entire character of the nation overnight. A written constitution has the tremendous value of creating a break on unfortunate legislation, because after all, any legislature could be led by the winds of change to alter the very nature of the country. Once you have a constitution, a written constitution, as we have in the United States, it becomes much more difficult to change the character of the nation. That's why it's so difficult to amend the constitution, because you don't want to have that change to any extent whatsoever.
We often hear, Dr. Montgomery, that the founding documents of the United States, the Declaration of Independence, and the U.S. Constitution make explicit reference to God. Is this true? Does the U.S. Constitution make explicit reference to God? Is it a Christian document?
Well, Here we've got to be careful. The Declaration of Independence speaks of nature and of nature's God. But nowhere in the Declaration of Independence is Jesus Christ mentioned. The Constitution of the United States doesn't even go that far. You don't have any inclusion in either the Declaration of Independence or in the Constitution of the United States of the nature of Jesus Christ or the way of salvation or anything that could possibly lead you to the conclusion of the Christian gospel. Now, if someone goes around saying, these documents are nevertheless Christian, the only possible conclusion is that the person thinks that you can have Christianity without Jesus Christ. And it shouldn't be very difficult to make the point that there is no Christianity without Jesus Christ. The reason why we have these preachers and their ilk running around on the 4th of July saying that these documents are Christian is that they desperately want to turn the documents into a kind of support for the Christian faith. And there's just no way you can do this. Now, indirectly, these documents reflect certain Christian teachings. For example, the limitation placed on government that you have in the Constitution of the United States, the separation of powers and the prevention of any one branch of government from overwhelming the rest, that balance of power is really to be understood in terms of original sin. The reason why we have to restrain the various branches of government and keep them in balance is because if we didn't do this, then the selfishness that follows from original sin would very easily carry things to the point of a dictatorship or an autocracy or something of that kind. But the mere fact that the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, recognize implicitly that man is a sinner doesn't make them Christian. I mean, my goodness, there are plenty of non-Christian writers such as the existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre and people like that who have seen that the human condition is a miserable sort of thing. That hardly makes them Christian. In order to understand Christianity, you've got to go to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and you can't find that in those documents.
Let's, if you would, lead us, if you would, Dr. Montgomery, through a brief history lesson on the Constitution, beginning in advance of its formation, in fact. Tell us what the Articles of Confederation were all about and why those were eventually deemed to be inadequate, why a constitutional convention was called there in the early months of 1787.
Well, the Articles of Confederation are just what the name implies. They allowed for a government which was so orientated toward states' rights that it was impossible to have a strong federal state. And all through American history, there has been this tension between states' rights and the central federal government. Conservatives have tended to be in favor of states' rights and against a strong federal government because of their dislike of centralism. But the fact of the matter is that you can't have a country unless you have a sufficiently strong central government that there is a single policy. There has to be, a single foreign policy. There has to be a single policy relating to military, taxation, stuff like that. It was seen that the Confederation would not adequately provide for a strong federal government. And that's why in the intervening years between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, conviction was reached that states had to give up their individual strengths in many instances in order to be able to have a strong federal government.
Now, I take it that the original intent of the Constitutional Convention was merely to revise the Articles of Confederation as they existed, make them more suitable to the situation on the ground in the colonies. Does the U.S. Constitution end up being a mere revision of the Articles of Confederation?
Oh, hardly. Hardly. The Articles of Confederation never allowed for the strength of a civil government, of a central government as we have it today. It's very interesting, too, that the development of our understanding of central government has come about largely through judicial interpretation of the Constitution. In the 20th century, it's been seen that you can't have a Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which don't extend across the board, which don't really impact the states as well as the country as a federal system. The great revolution, the understanding of the Constitution that's occurred in the 20th century has been to see that protection, civil liberties, and that sort of thing must not be taken away by individual states. It isn't enough that these are guaranteed in some general abstract sense for the entire federal government. They've got to be available to people individually. You can't, for example, allow racial prejudice and that sort of thing to prevail in the individual states while at the same time maintaining the principle of equality that's given in the 14th Amendment.
This kind of brings us to the question of representation, which was the heart of the debate, it appears, between the first Constitutional Convention and the final ratification of the U.S. Constitution. There were the two plans, the Virginia and the New Jersey plan. One said, look, we need to have population being the basis for representation. And the other one said, no, it really has to be equal representation for all states, regardless of their size or population. Very interesting in there that we've got things like Alexander Hamilton calling for a strong executive branch with a president elected for life, an idea that obviously didn't fly. How did it all eventually shake out?
The end result, as we have it, is one where there is a fine balance maintained. The principle behind this is that any powers that are not given to the central government are reserved to the states. And that means that you go to the Constitution and find out what those common principles are that apply across the board. Then, when there is no central requirement given in the Constitution, then, of course, there is latitude that permits the states to make their own decisions. I mean, one interesting example of this has to do with the practice of law. There is nothing in the Constitution of the United States which establishes a national bar or national requirements for lawyers. Not at all. There is plenty in the Constitution which indicates the rights that all citizens have, and those rights exist across the board. But because there isn't any clause in the Constitution as to the legal profession, that means that each individual state can establish its own standards, and that's exactly what's happened. In California, for example, it's possible to take a correspondence course and eventually take the California bar examination. Not that you would necessarily pass it, because it's the most difficult in the United States, but you could do that. Whereas in virtually all of the other states, I think all of the other states, you are not able to do this. You've got to attend a resident law school or have a period of apprenticeship with a lawyer. So there is flexibility, but the flexibility is not on the fundamental stuff. The fundamental stuff is maintained across the board.
Now, part and parcel of the original Constitution, when it was finally ratified and enacted, was the ability to change it. Why did the Constitutional Fathers want a document that could be changed?
Well, the fact is that the Constitution does not represent divine revelation. We've already made this point. If it is a human product, then there are conceivably circumstances that might arise in the future which would require some actions that the Founding Fathers had not thought of. And so you've got to have some means of modifying the Constitution, but you want to make this very difficult. Because if you don't make it very difficult, then there's no difference between a constitution and ordinary laws passed by a legislature. And as we've seen, legislatures do not necessarily act rationally under all conditions. So if you make it very difficult to change the Constitution, then you are keeping a single stable government. I believe it was in Nebraska in the 1920s when the legislature passed a law establishing the value of pi at an even 3 in order to facilitate mathematical calculations within the state, not 3.151416 or 22 sevenths, but an even 3. Now, if those lame brains had actually succeeded in such an action, my goodness, public buildings would have fallen. You couldn't build anything. And I understand that exactly the same legislature passed a law which said when two trains come to a stop at any intersection within the state, neither shall start until the other has gone. Well, if you took that literally, that would stop all train transport within the state. Legislatures, parliaments, have come up with some pretty dumb things. And so you certainly want to keep a constitutional check on what they're doing. But you've got to have at least the possibility of modifying that constitution if needs arise.
Let's talk about the Constitution itself, article by article, and then as we go through the seven articles of the Constitution itself, we'll also talk about the Bill of Rights. The first article talks about the legislature establishing the Senate and the House of Representatives. Why two houses?
Well, in order to take into account what you said earlier, in order to take into account both population and the interests of individual states, for example, the Senate consists of two senators from each state. That therefore has no reference whatsoever to the size of the population of the state. Whereas in the case of the House of Representatives, you have quite a variety in that regard. Quite a number of people coming in and acting as representatives. The idea is to provide different ways by which the public can be represented. And this business of separation of powers appears on the scene throughout. The founding fathers did not want to have power concentrated in any one single area. They recognized the dangers of this. And there they were living off of the inherited capital of historic Christianity. Because of original sin, we mustn't allow anybody to act in an unchecked manner. You need to have power checks all the way across the board. And you find this throughout the Constitution. That's why you have two houses. Then it isn't possible for either one of these houses to control everything.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery here on Issues Etc. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Montgomery is author and editor of more than 50 books, including The Shaping of America. You can find this book and find out more about this book on the web at CILTPP.com. CILTPP.com. That's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. CILTPP.com. They also have a phone number. It's area code 780-461-3076. 780-461-3076. The book by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is called The Shaping of America. Article 2 of the Constitution has to do with the chief executive, the president. What's distinctive here?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
What is distinctive in Article 2 as the constitutional founders described what the chief executive would be like, the president?
Well, you see, again, you have this limitation of powers. That you don't have a president for life at all. Now, it's true that at the time of Roosevelt, three terms were in the picture, but subsequent to this, a law was passed within the spirit of the Constitution that limited the president to two terms. And in the Constitution, the president's function is that of an executive. He doesn't have all power. What he does is to carry out the laws which the legislature, the Congress, brings about.
I also note that in the original Constitution, apart from any amendments, the president is not elected by a popular vote as we would understand it today.
Oh, this is true. And there you have the founding fathers' suspicion of pure democracy. They recognized, as Plato did, that pure democracy can equal anarchy. You know, the voice of the people is not necessarily the voice of God. Sometimes it's very different from that. And so they set up a rather complex electoral college system that would act as a check on it. That has not proved entirely successful. And it's clear, for example, in the disputed previous election, the Bush-Gore election, that this may require some modification. But the idea behind it is perfectly sound, that you don't just want to count, noses and arrive at a conclusion as simply as that. The majority may not actually be presenting as serious a view as we want.
If you read that second article on the president, and then you also go back and read through the various articles on the legislature, they talk about impeachment, the removal of the president himself. We've got about 2 minutes here before we have to go to a break, Dr. Montgomery. Why did they envision the need to remove a president?
Well, again, because of the recognition that people are not perfect, and you can't necessarily assume that a president is always going to do the right thing. So you've got to have some means of removal, though that, again, is going to be a difficult task because you don't want to upset stability in the state.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution during this week following the Independence Day holiday. If you have a question or a comment on the Constitution, give us a call now during this break, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You're listening to Issues Etc., and we're coming to you live this Tuesday, July the 6th. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, a regular guest here on the program, professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, an author and editor of more than 50 books, including one called The Shaping of America. When we come back, we're going to talk about Article 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, 3 dealing with the third branch of government, one that probably in the minds of Americans today seems most significant. We hear all the time about judicial activism. Here's the question when we come back. When the constitutional framers sat down and thought about the judicial branch of government at all levels, did they conceive of what we call nowadays activist judges, and does the Constitution speak to that issue today? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our conversation will conclude, along with your phone calls, as we talk with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, about the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the so-called Bill of Rights. We'll find out how they are unique when it comes to, or at least unique in their time, when it comes to the formation of good government. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc. International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on why he joined the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I went to Cornell University as a pagan undergraduate. At Cornell, I was converted to biblical Christianity through evangelical witness. Then, before joining a church, I compared the various major doctrinal statements with the Greek New Testament. Amazingly, the Lutheran confessions fitted Scripture exactly, and it was a theology which centered everything on the cross of Christ. The Missouri Synod, with all its human weaknesses, remains the only mainline church which consistently takes a serious view of historic Christian doctrine.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Conservatives aren't finding much to smile about in this year's Supreme Court session. Some are calling it bleak. Correspondent Keith Peters spoke to two court watchers to get their take on the Supreme Court's rulings in the first part of 2004.
Justice Antonin Scalia had harsh words for his colleagues on the court, saying they were incapable of admitting that some matters, any matters, are none of its business. The American Center for Law and Justice's Colby May says conservatives have a right to be concerned about the court's increasing power over government by the people.
This court seems willing to put itself in the business of the other branches, and also seems willing to have a very strange view when it comes to religious liberties and religious rights.
Pro-family advocates cite the recent decisions regarding online child pornography, the denial of state funding for a divinity student's education, and the dodging of the Pledge of Allegiance case as examples. Richard Thompson of the Thomas More Law Center says this term is just another example of activist judges making laws.
Changing the culture of our society. These judges have replaced the rule of law with the rule of their ideological will.
Thompson calls it a tyranny of the courts, but reminds us that there are two other branches of government.
Those branches of government must become courageous enough to stand and stop allowing the Supreme Court and other federal and state courts to take over what is their responsibilities.
He says another one is very simple. Appoint judges who will follow the law, not make it. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Thompson longs for the days of judicial restraint, where judges leave certain issues to the legislative branch, where he says the Founding Fathers intended them to be. Once again this term, many of the issues were decided by swing voters Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Volunteers are needed for the upcoming 26th annual YMCA Book Fair at the Carondelet Family YMCA. They're located at 600 Loughborough in St. Louis. Several opportunities are available, including sorting and pricing books. The upcoming book fair is August 27th through September 1st. However, they're looking for their volunteers now, and they will train you. For more information, please call the Carondelet Family YMCA. That's the 26th annual book fair.
Was fascism defeated in World War II, or is it alive and well today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is Modern Fascism by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section, or by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $17.99 plus shipping and handling. Modern Fascism, our book of the month.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the teachings of Joel Osteen. Bob Leko of Discernment Ministry International will be our guest. We'll also talk to Pastor Mark Sell of Concordia Publishing House about Christians and culture, two kingdom theology, tomorrow on Issues Etc. Our subject during this hour for the next 25 minutes with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, the U.S. Constitution. Now, Dr. Montgomery joins us from Strasbourg, France. That is home of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, of which Dr. Montgomery is the chairman. Dr. Montgomery, briefly tell us about this annual academy in France.
Well, the purpose of it is to provide answers to the non-Christian, offering the best defense of the Christian faith that we can provide. There are nine areas in which the defense of the faith is dealt with, scientific, philosophical, legal, theological, etc. And the idea is to train the people who have come to take part in this so that they can go back to their communities and present a reason for the hope that is within them. That's what Peter tells us we're supposed to do. The Academy is now in its eighth year, and it's limited to only 20 people each year with four specialists in the defense of the faith. It's become very, very popular. The Academy was completely full this year, and we have over half of the places already committed for next summer. So if any of the listeners to Issues Etc. Want to participate in this, they should certainly get in touch with us as soon as possible. Obviously, the Academy is going to be filled for July 2005 end of September.
Folks, we'd be happy to send you a free information brochure on the ninth annual, that's next summer's, European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Just call us at 1-800-737-7000. 1-800-737-0172. We'll send you a free brochure on the Academy, 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Montgomery, Article 3 of the Constitution establishes specifically the Supreme Court, and then more generally, the lower courts. What did they have in mind? You've talked a lot about the balance of powers, the checks and balances here. What did they have in mind for a Supreme Court of nine individuals who were appointed for life, unlike the other elected officials?
The reason for appointing them for life was so that they could not be influenced by elections, by public opinion during electioneering, that sort of thing. The function of the Supreme Court was very specific. The function of the court was to make sure that the laws passed by the legislature, by Congress, did not violate the Constitution of the United States. In other words, they engaged in a process by which they evaluated what the legislature did and thereby either legitimated it or indicated that it was illegitimate. The problem today is very largely that the Supreme Court of the United States and certainly some of the lesser federal courts see their function in a much wider sense than that. They see their function as creating law through judicial decision rather than critiquing law as passed by legislatures.
We talked before about Article 5, about the built-in ability to amend the U.S. Constitution. In Article 6, and I do want to come back to judicial activism a little bit later, but to get through the articles, in Article 6, it seems to have to do with kind of the miscellanea, maybe I'm misreading it, of what goes on in the legislature and how the legislature is organized. Can you make sense of this?
That's perfectly correct.
And then in Article 7, finally, to round off the end of the Constitution, it provides for its own ratification. Why did they make it so cumbersome, not only to change it, but also to get the thing passed in the first place?
Well, had they made it awfully easy, then presumably the value of it would be far less for those who agreed to it. That's one reason. And another reason is, of course, that they had to be sure that the states were serious about this. It's very difficult to give up power. Lord Acton, the editor of the first Cambridge Modern History, coined the phrase that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. When you have power, you definitely do not want to give it up. And so the founding fathers had to be sure that each state really understood what it was doing in entering into this. And, you know, even with all of that difficulty in ratification, when you come to the 19th century, you have the southern states believing that they can move away from this. And that, of course, was the problem that was fundamental in the Civil War.
The first 10 amendments of the Constitution, which occurred, I think, barely a year after the Constitution was actually enacted, is probably in the Jefferson administration where they finally were enacted as a Bill of Rights. Why do they go together, and why, in the minds of historians and constitutional scholars, do the first 10 amendments stand as kind of a higher caliber set of amendments to the Constitution than the other, 17 that have come since?
The reason is that the first 10 amendments constitute, as we call it, a Bill of Rights. These are the fundamental guarantees of personal liberty, and thus they have a tremendously important place. The equivalent over here in France is the Declaration of the Rights of Man. But the Declaration of the Rights of Man is, like the American Declaration of Independence, a statement of ideals. It is not a legal document. In France, there isn't any equivalent of the American Bill of Rights on the basis of which you can legislate or actually enforce, I should say. This means that if a policeman grabs you and takes you into the back room and lets you have it because he's convinced you're guilty, you don't have any amendments by which you can haul him into court. I mean, if you could prove that he hit you with no reason whatsoever, you could do something, but there isn't a guarantee of personal liberty which you can litigate in the way in which you can on the basis of the American Bill of Rights. These first 10 amendments are of tremendous importance. They were the model in the 20th century for the European Convention on Human Rights, which is litigated, of course, here in Strasbourg, France. And interestingly enough, countries that don't have an incorporated Bill of Rights, like the United States, countries in Europe that don't have that, have to go to an international court in order to make sure that their rights are sustained.
Were they an afterthought, or were they always kind of in the planning, but not necessary in order to get the Constitution up and running, so to speak?
Well, that's hard to say. The fact of the matter is that the model for the first 10 amendments was the Virginia Bill of Rights that Jefferson had so much to do with, and it's hard to say why exactly they were not included in the original document. The reason may well be that there were so many technical matters that had to be taken care of, so many fundamental matters as to the organization of the departments of government, that this was just not as central. It's interesting, for example, on an entirely different subject, that Protestants have often been criticized because the first Protestant missionaries didn't get out until the 17th century, whereas Catholic missionaries were out doing all sorts of things. But the first step in the Reformation was to get the fundamental doctrines established, and then once you got those established, you could go ahead and take care of other things. And in a sense, with the U.S. Constitution, you first of all had to get the country solidly on a legal footing, and then immediately thereafter you had to guarantee the rights of the individual citizens of it.
So it's very similar in that respect to what we're seeing going on in Iraq, for instance, where they first have to we have a nation, there are people there, but there has to be a basis for government on which they operate.
Sure there does, and if you don't have that, then, of course, you've got anarchy. Now, in Iraq, you've got anarchy in spades in many respects, but the only way that this will ever be reduced is by having a reliable and solid government established, and that's got to be done, first of all. There are things worse than bad government, namely no government at all, and the Founding Fathers recognized this.
The First Amendment to the Constitution grants the so-called five freedoms: freedom of religion and the exercise thereof, speech and the press, peaceable assembly, and then petition to the government for redress for grievances. Why are these so important?
Well, they are the essence of civil liberty. If you don't have freedom of expression, and if your freedom of expression is repressed, then it really doesn't make all that difference that say your property is protected. You know, one of the greatest mistake that was ever made by the Marxists was their materialistic mistake in which they said if people are given enough materially, then they don't have to have any personal freedom. And it was said of East Germans during the communist regime that they had plenty of material things, and their lives were utterly miserable. They were reduced to existence because they didn't have personal freedom. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution places in central position for the rights of the individual freedom of expression and, of course, particularly freedom of religion. And even though the Constitution of the United States is not a Christian document, it indirectly has contributed greatly to the Christian cause by creating an open marketplace of ideas where the gospel can be freely presented along with the other viewpoints. Because when the gospel is presented decisively and when the evidence for it is given, it triumphs over the opposition. This is far better than a state where you are limited only to one religious position. Even if that religious position happened to be correct, if nobody has any opportunity to make any choices, then the thing becomes nothing but dead orthodoxy.
Folks, it's Tuesday, July the 6th. We're coming to you live here on Issues Etc. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest as we talk about the U.S. Constitution. We have about 10 more minutes left in this conversation and plenty of time to take your phone calls. Call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 with your question or your comment. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I don't think we have time to go through every of the first 10 amendments one by one, but I do want to ask a couple questions about two of them. The Second Amendment begins a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. How is this to be rightly understood since we no longer have a militia but a professional volunteer army?
Yes, actually, the Second Amendment has been badly misused by the gun lobby as an argument for what? Everyone having his own cannon. This is a certainly not what was in mind in the case of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers were in a position then when personal protection was often limited to the individual, and they wanted to make sure that the government didn't take away all means of personal protection, as it happened in some totalitarian European societies. That's what they were talking about. They certainly were not saying that once you have an adequate police force and once you have suitable control over the negative elements in society, that everybody should still be allowed to go around shooting to protect themselves. The gun lobby has made a terrible mistake in arguing that kind of position. The negative effects of this untrammeled ownership of firearms in the United States, the effects have just been dreadful, perfectly awful, and a society should be a society of law, not a society in which people are out shooting each other.
Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk first to Steve. He's calling from Eureka. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, I would have to take exception with his previous discussion on the Second Amendment. If you look at the other nine amendments to the Constitution, it's very clear that they are all there for one specific reason, and that is to protect the individual against the big government. Why should the Second Amendment be any different? And I think the people that put that together wanted people to have guns because they want to make it difficult for the government to do things like, say, the Nazis did and the communists did in Russia, because one of the first things both of those groups did before they slaughtered massive amounts of people is to take their guns away.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. So, Dr. Montgomery, was the purpose of the Second Amendment to allow people to protect themselves from the government with their personally owned firearms?
Well, that may well have been a factor, but of course, today, the argument against gun control has nothing to do with protection against the government at all. The argument for no gun control or very reduced gun control is that one ought to be able to protect oneself from other individuals within the society, from criminals and the like. The argument is, well, if the criminals have got guns, why can't everybody else have them? And that is an invitation to anarchy. I mean, I've never heard anybody argue today that the real reason why we need to have guns is so that we can protect ourselves against the police or protect ourselves against, what, the tax collectors or the mayor or some other public official. I mean, clearly that is not the point today. The point today is whether or not people should be able to take the law in their own hands and engage in a quasi-military kind of self-protection. And you start that kind of thing, and by George, you have anarchy and misery. And you know, with sinners, It's true that they can always find some way to make other people miserable, but if you allow them to have weapons of destruction, the amount of harm they can cause is infinitely increased.
The last two amendments, I wanted to ask about those because they seem to go hand in hand, and they do speak to this question, actually. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That's Amendment 9. And then 10, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. What's the point here?
The point here, as we made it earlier in the program, is that the Constitution is not an attempt to describe all rights or an attempt to set forth all of the all the prerogatives of government. What it's doing is saying these are fundamental, and therefore, if something is not mentioned, then it's what in theology is called an adiaphoron. It's something that is neutral, and it's possible then for the states to make their own decisions about it. This of course allows for flexibility. It allows for the states to operate in those areas where the federal government has not legislated. And as far as freedoms are concerned, it keeps the government from the idea that there is a short list of rights, and if the rights are not in that list, you don't have them. You know, one of the differences between American government and many governments in history is that in American government, you're able to do whatever isn't prohibited. But in the political theory of many states, especially totalitarian states, you have the notion that unless the government gives you a right to do something, you're not going to be able to do it at all. It makes one think of a certain Far Eastern government where the government has legislated on practically everything. If you spit on the sidewalk, for goodness sake, you're going to be arrested, or drop a gum wrapper. In fact, in one of these cities in the Far East, you are not allowed to chew gum within the confines of the national capital at all. Now, thank goodness we're not living in a situation of that kind.
Several final questions, and our time is short. First of all, is the U.S. Constitution a document, an evolving document that changes with time and culture? Was it intended to be this way?
Well, there was the recognition that it might require amendment, as we've already said. But the whole idea of a constitution is to have an unchanging standard by which you can judge the actions of legislatures, and by which the actions of legislatures are able to be checked and prevented from altering the very nature of your society. And that's why strict constitutional construction is so important. If the Constitution is a kind of wax nose that can be twisted in any direction, then you might as well not have one. You might as well live in a society where the legislature, you know, tomorrow can pass the law that pi equals an even 3 or whatever. That we certainly don't want to have. And fortunately, the Founding Fathers, though they were not Christian in most instances, were living off of inherited capital of the Christian faith. They recognized the fallibility and the self-centeredness of a fallen race, and therefore they set up a government in which no one element of the society could overwhelm everything, and we've got to make sure that that is preserved. If that isn't preserved, you're going to have a dictatorship of one sort or another. It can be a dictatorship of judges or a dictatorship of the executive or whatever. The reason why it was so important to get rid of Nixon was not that he wasn't a great man. He was in many respects, but he went beyond his executive powers, and his notion of executive privilege was such that he was not willing to be controlled by the other branches of government. And we've got to make sure no branch of government remains a law unto itself.
So with that said, and with only a minute before we have to go, the branch that seems to be a bit out of control of late is the judicial branch. What can be done to restrain judicial activism?
Well, I'm afraid the only way really to do this is to make sure that judges have the right kind of training, and even more than that, the right kind of philosophy of life. It is dreadfully important to have people with a sound value system in the judiciary, because they can cause so much harm if they don't have that, particularly because of the lifetime appointments. So that is simply essential. It is, of course, always possible for Congress to keep feeding the laws in, and the judicial branch can get a pretty clear picture of the way in which the country wants to move. But in the last analysis, the answer is to have more people with a sound value system in these positions. And that's why it's so important that those judicial appointments that Bush has tried to get through actually succeed. I think Bush understands this, and I think that the judicial appointments that he would have come into existence are exactly the ones that the country needs.
With no more than 30 seconds, given our little reflection here on the Constitution, how has it fared? How has it proven itself over 200-some-odd years?
It's certainly the most enduring and successful constitution in world history. And the constitutions of many, many other nations have been based upon it. The constitutions of former British colonies and new nations throughout the world invariably use the U.S. Constitution as a model, not following it slavishly, but that in itself, it seems to me, is a great testimony to its success.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. Thank you for being our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery.
It's always a pleasure.
Dr. Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's authored and edited more than 50 books, including The Shaping of America. Now, you can order this book by calling the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy at area code 780-461-3076, 780-461-3076, or you can check out their website and the book, The Shaping of America, at CILTPP.com, CILTPP.com. When we come back from this break, Dr. Stephen Hine will be our guest. Seems like a long time since we've talked with him. We're going to be talking about sanctification, to be made holy. Is that something that God does in a different way than when he declares us to be righteous for Christ's sake alone? We'll answer that question when we come back on Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.